Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's February 25th, 2019, and I'm Kara Santa Maria. Thanks for joining me this week. In just a few minutes, we're going to chat with Gary Paul Nabhan about his brand newest book. But before we do that, I want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible this week and every week. And that's because of the support that you make to the show. One of the most obvious ways to support the show is to go to patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge your support like the following individuals have done: Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell, among so many others. Thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart. If you want to support the show in other ways, you can visit talknerdymerch.com and buy a cool t-shirt, maybe a cool hoodie, who knows, maybe a book signed by me, got those too. Or you can rate and review on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on all the podcasts. Tell your friends, tell your family. That is the kind of thing that will help get the word out about this here humble show. All right, guys, I'm excited about this week's chat. It's a fascinating one. So let me tell you a little bit about Gary before we get started. When he was at the University of Arizona, he co-founded Native Seeds and Search. Those were organizations that co-hosted national conferences on community-based seed banks, nonprofit organizations. He's done a lot of work as director of conservation across a lot of different outlets. Then at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, he became the founding director of the Center for Sustainable Environments, and then went back to Tucson. And now he is at the University of Arizona on faculty there as a research social scientist with the Southwest Center. He serves as the Kellogg Endowed Chair in Southwestern Borderlands Food and Water Security. He also founded the Center for Regional Food Studies, and he helped the initiative to have UNESCO designate Tucson as the first city of gastronomy in the U.S., which I think he mentions during the show. Pretty freaking cool. So, like I said, he's a celebrated nature writer. He's an activist. He's also an ethnobiologist. And he has written several books. But this time, this week, we're going to be talking about mesquite, an arboreal love affair. So, without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Gary Paul Nabhan. Well, Gary, thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm grateful to be with you, Kara.
So I'm excited to talk about, I think this is your newest book at this point, but I know that you've written several, Mesquite, an Arboreal Love Affair. And so this book is sort of an amalgamation, right, of many of your loves. It's about nature, it's about trees, it's about food, it's about sustainability, it's about biodiversity. What made you want to focus specifically on the mesquite?
Well, mesquite is the iconic tree of the region that I live in. I live by the U.S.-Mexico border, and mesquite is in every county along the U.S.-Mexico border and covers 200 million acres in the United States, which means it's one of the most widespread trees in North America, but we don't typically think of it like that. But it's also a cultural and ecological keystone. It's in the symbolism and the ceremonies and the food system and the habitat management of every culture in this region.
You know, it's interesting because when I think of mesquite, being somebody from who was born and raised in Texas, I immediately go to, you know, smoky barbecue. It's the first thing I think of. It's kind of the only thing that I think is brought to mind when I hear that word.
Well, that's right. And mesquite wood is in over $200 million of sales of barbecue products a year, both the wood itself and briquettes and even mesquite smoke, like I'm sure you've had in some potato chips if you grew up in Texas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, it's to me, I think it conjures a conversation about food. I think that that's probably the case for many people. But of course, as you write in your book, it's so much more than that, isn't it?
Well, that's right. And even the need to use mesquite wood for barbecuing steaks and other foods has not been the major use of mesquite as a food. The bean pods of mesquite that are called pechita in Spanish are the food that has been part of American diets for more than 8,000 years. And yet most people who have mesquite pods and trees in their yard probably have never tasted them. And yet up until a century ago, it was the mainstay of most native desert cultures in the Americas.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Well, it's a remarkable thing. The food is really the equivalent of what carob is in the Mediterranean area of the Old World. So the carob trees also have pods that are ground into a fine flour. And many people have bought carob flour from health food stores. And there's virtually very little difference between carob flour or carob meal and mesquite flour or mesquite meal. And now there's a resurgence of use of mesquite pod flour because it's like a very sweet but nutritionally rich pastry flour from Austin, Texas, all the way to the Arizona-California border.
Wow. So we use it to smoke our foods. We actually can eat portions, or I guess, like you said, the flowers, the pods of the tree itself. But there's even beyond its place in our kind of nutritional history, there's a lot of ceremony that that this tree represents, isn't there?
That's right. From the Aztecs to the Hopi and the Paiute up near the Grand Canyon, mesquite is sort of part of seasonal rituals. It forecasts the timing of planting corn and other crops, because if mesquites are flowering, indigenous farmers know that it's already past the last freeze. And if they plant corn, the corn won't wither and die with a freeze. And there's many, many other ritual and medicinal uses of mesquite. And sometimes it's hard to sort of separate apart the pharmaceutical uses of a food and medicinal plant from the ritual uses. So it has a very, very rich history. And yet, because of how our country was settled by Europeans, a lot of that's been obscured since the deserts were sort of the last place in the United States to be deeply settled. And so a lot of that history has been lost.
So not just unknown sort of to, you know, I mean, I'm trying to figure out how to put this, but maybe we should just be frank, to colonizers, I guess, to Westerners who actively were the ones losing this history. But even within indigenous cultures that remain, there's some loss of these traditions as well.
That's right. And if you lived in Texas part of your childhood, you also know that mesquite to many ranchers was like the devil. They thought it was an invader that was infesting their grasslands, where all the ecological studies showed that those grasslands were never pure grasslands. They were sort of savannas with mesquite trees and oaks out in the middle of the grasses. And in the case of mesquite, cattle also use that for shade and emergency feed. So it's not just that we've lost a lot of that knowledge, but mesquite took on sort of a bad guy role as in the settling of the West, because people wanted grass, not multi-stem shrubs like mesquite gets in Texas.
You know, I think about it, I'm not even sure I know what a mesquite tree looks like. It is a tree, right?
It is, but it's a short tree. I mean, some can get 40 to 60 feet tall on floodplains, but it's also a multi-stem shrub in most of Texas, where it might have 10 to 15 inch to 4 inch wide trunks or stems rather than one big trunk. And the more you cut it, the more it resprouts at the base. And that's why it sort of aggravated Texas and Arizona and New Mexican ranchers that thought they could just chainsaw it down to the base of the trunk, and they'd get rid of it, and it would always re-sprout. But it has lovely foliage, little leaflets that have parts to them called pinnae that are about the size of your baby fingers, fingernail, 8 to 10 beautiful little pinnae or leaflets like that, that then are in two rows that then multiply out. And the flowers are beautiful. The trunks are voluptuous. They have some of the most expressive curves that you've ever seen. Don't want to get too sensuous here, but it's really a lovely tree.
And so what about, you know, we've kind of talked a little bit, I mean, obviously there's much more depth to get into, about historical use in indigenous cultures than we talked about Western destruction of this kind of rich history and how we co-opted that use in Western society. But what about Mexican society? You know, you said that this spans the U.S.-Mexico border and covers 200 million acres just on the other side of that border. Obviously, there's no real ecological difference. There's no real biome difference, but culturally, there's a very big difference because those lines are arbitrary lines, those border lines. So is there a Mexican appreciation of the mesquite that is that's different from the American appreciation?
You've hit it right on the money, Kara. And what's interesting about that is that mesquite is a basis of a number of cottage industries in Mexico that persist until this day. So we have a 6-foot long table made out of big planks of mesquite in our dining room that sort of glows in the sunlight. It's one of the most beautiful woods you can imagine. And there's dozens, if not hundreds, of craftsmen in Mexico using mesquite wood for guitars, for making tables and chairs and cabinets and tiles and all kinds of other wood products. Beautiful, beautiful guitars. Secondly, people still use the ground up pods for a meal like cornmeal to make cookies with. So if you go down in the Chihuahuan Desert to the area of Torreon, Coahuila, and Gomez Palacios, right on the Durango, Chihuahua, Coahuila border in sort of the deepest, hottest part of the desert, there's mesquite cookies available every morning along the roadside in makeshift stands where people are just used to having mesquite cookies and pinoles, which is kind of a porridge-like food when you mix it with water, milk, atoles. That's another one of these porridge-like foods eaten in the morning. And that still holds on. And in fact, people store mesquite pods to have as an emergency cattle feed year-round in the Chihuahuan Desert. So it is not at all diminished in its economic importance in northern Mexico.
It's just, it's so fascinating how much culture really does end up changing, pruning, in many ways evolving the natural world around us, how big that interplay is. Because of course, as human beings, we have completely changed the landscape and our culture is such an important part of that.
Well, and of course, now the fear is that the proposed wall along the border would even change that border area even more. I was part of a effort by Mexican scientists, led by Mexican scientists, but over 10,000 of us signed a resolution and plan for action called Scientists United, Wildlife Divided, about how the wildlife that lives in mesquite woodlands and savannas, from jaguars to bears to Mexican wolves to antelope and bison, will all be negatively affected by the border. Mm-hmm. And so almost every rancher in Mexico values mesquite habitat for its wildlife habitat, that quail and deer and javelina and antelope use it. But they also value that habitat for its role in making mesquite honey that many Mexicans are beekeepers that make this delicious mesquite honey that I think is up there with guajillo and Tupelo honey as the greatest, most flavorful honeys of North America.
Yeah, I mean, I think we often forget, we really haven't talked about the proposed border wall much on the show. And of course, as somebody who's incredibly pro-science, but also incredibly, I think, I've made no hiding of my political views. You know, I think anybody listening to the show would be unsurprised to find that I am, you know, completely against, for many reasons, putting up a wall between our two nations. But even beyond that, I don't think we've taken the time to talk about the ecological and, you know, biodiversity implications of literally making a barrier between what's, you know, it's not even a land bridge. It's just open space right now. And for all intents and purposes, just cutting off this range for so many different species could be devastating, couldn't it?
That's right. And it will affect dozens of threatened and endangered species. But I'm not so much trying to politicize this issue on a show that's basically about mesquite and its value. I'm saying that mesquite could be part of a solution. Hmm. I think everyone, whether they want a wall or not, understands that ultimately we have to deal with the root causes of our border issues. And one of those root causes is the disparity in access to markets, to food, and to jobs with livable wages. So about 50 scientists, chefs, mesquite craftsmen, mesquite whiskey and beer makers helped me write a thing that we've just released this week called the Mesquite Manifesto. And the Mesquite Manifesto is a vision for reducing the disparities and creating jobs on both sides of the border on a restoration economy that's anchored in the many products that mesquite provides. What we're suggesting is that we have training centers on both sides of the border. Some of the people who get trained in how to make mesquite furniture and mesquite pod flour and mesquite beer and mesquite whiskey may want to stay on the Mexican side of the border where their families are. But others, if they get that skill set, can get jobs with livable wages on the U.S. side, where really for the same work, you get paid 5 to 10 times as much as on the Mexican side. So unless we deal with that disparity between the two sides of the border in terms of economic opportunities for families, I think both Republicans and Democrats understand that we're still going to have these challenges at the border that people have different opinions on about the wall. But I don't think anyone would mind if we actually solve those problems by dealing with the root causes, the poverty, disparity, and lack of access to food and jobs.
Absolutely. And food justice, social justice with regard to access to affordable, nutritious food is something that you are incredibly passionate about. And it really does shape your perspective in your work and your writings, doesn't it?
Well, deeply so, Kara. I have to say that part of the last 20 years, I've worked on promoting foods that reduce or prevent diabetes, which is the major killer of people in Mexico now and on Indian reservations here in the Southwest. But the diabetes epidemic is touching every ethnicity in every part of North America. So African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Native Americans are but three of the many ethnic groups that are vulnerable to that. And ironically, mesquite is one of the best foods for controlling blood sugar levels. Mesquite and carob have a substance in them called galactomannan that lowers blood sugar levels after a meal and increases insulin secretion production, and that helps stabilize the pancreas so that the pancreas doesn't go into stress and diabetes is aggravated. So ironically, a food that has almost fallen out of American diets is desperately needed at this point in time, because the cost of dealing with diabetes through healthy foods is far less than the cost of building dialysis machines for people with advanced diabetes and health clinics in every village along the border, because half of the adults now suffer from diabetes. So we need to deal with the root causes. And fortunately, mesquite is an absolutely delicious food with a wonderful texture. And mesquite whiskey and mesquite beer isn't going to help people. But there's also mesquite coffee substitutes and mesquite tortillas and mesquite empanadas. And so it's really not a food that's limited to just one kind of use.
Oh, that's fascinating. Is it something that, you know, if you're not, I live in California now in Los Angeles, so if I'm not growing mesquite in my yard, is it something I have access to? Like, how do I eat mesquite?
Well, now some bakeries from Los Angeles to Austin, Texas are getting mesquite from nearby counties. For instance, mesquite grows over by Riverside, naturally just over the mountains and down the pass, I guess, from you. It grows in San Diego County. And in Arizona, we have about 25 hammer mills, thousand to 2,000 pound machine that pulverizes dry mesquite pods into a meal or flour that can be used by bakers and brewers and tortilla makers. Mm-hmm. So this is really emerging in Tucson, Arizona alone. We just did a tally for our UNESCO City of Gastronomy. We have more than 25 mesquite-based products, and you can go into half dozen coffee shops, independently owned coffee shops in Tucson, and get a mesquite-flavored cafe latte every morning of the year. So
Nice. It's
no longer so obscure that you can't find it. There's even mesquite products in Whole Foods.
That's so cool. Okay. So yeah, we can keep our eyes open and look around for it and not just know that we're kind of making a decision that's potentially better for our own health, but better for the strength of the environment, ecology in general, and also for, like you said, this kind of larger conversation about food justice. You know, I'm interested, kind of maybe not moving away from the mesquite specifically, but this isn't the only organism that you've focused your career studying. You've written several books at this point, and they really all have that central through line about kind of our place in nature and this conversation about food justice. So when did you first start this journey, and why did you get into it?
Well, that's such a great question, Kara. I grew up in a Lebanese American family where my grandfather was a fruit peddler. And he was very poor. He was a refugee from a crisis in Syria, much like the one that is happening right now. And I'm sure he suffered near starvation, or at least hunger, on his way out of war-torn Syria. But a century later, after his own departure from Syria and resettling in the United States, I became acquainted with other desert peoples here in the Southwest and in northern Mexico. And one of the guys I worked with on a food and farming project on the Tohono-O'odham Reservation was my best buddy. And at age 32, at such a young age, he died of adult onset diabetes and the complications from a poor diet. But he worked hard. He worked with me on farms and gardens on a reservation the size of Connecticut, a big area that we were working together on. And his death just devastated me. He was such a fine person. And I just said, you know, I could study a million different things in this world, but I need to deal with this issue of healthy food, food justice, and food security. So the same week the Mesquite book came out, another book came out from Island Press that I've worked on the last couple of years called Food from the Radical Center, Healing Our Lands and Communities. And that's success stories about projects that bring people together of different races, to heal the urban-rural divide, to heal the science-faith divide, to heal the black-white divide. And it's really showing how food recovery projects and the restoration of food-producing landscapes is one of the few realms in which the divided America that we see all around us today is actually coming towards some kind of middle ground where people appreciate one another's skills and talents and values, because I think we all ultimately care that our kids and our parents or elders have healthy food. And as I said before, because of diabetes and heart disease, most of the things killing Americans today are nutrition-related diseases, not war or car accidents. It's the side effects, the collateral damage of cheap calories and fast foods.
And that's really a huge difference post-industrial revolution, isn't it? Because when we look at, you know, historical body shapes, you know, you can see these things in romantic era paintings, and conversations about access, poverty, the differences between rich and poor. And there's always been, at least in the Western world, massive disparities between rich and poor, but they are growing in a way. And the difference, it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, the difference, it seems like, in our modern era is that food has become, calories, like you said, have become cheap. And so we're actually seeing that the problems with obesity and the problems with this kind of nutritionally deficient yet calorically dense diets are happening in the most impoverished people, which really is the big tragedy.
And it's a tragedy as well as an irony that oftentimes poor people had a more nutritionally dense diet,
historically,
and fewer empty calories historically, that's right, than they do today. So the poor Mexican and Native American families I worked with in my 20s and 30s ate a lot of beans that were very good for them, used a lot of wild greens that in Spanish from Texas to California people call quelites or verdolagas or chuales, that were really, really healthy wild foods that they could get from the edges of roads or fields. And these were terrific sources of fiber, vitamins, minerals, and weren't the empty calorie kind of thing that we now see with big gulp drinks, 32-ounce beverages that 8-year-old kids are drinking in the summer, or all the snack foods that line up virtually half of all the shelves in mini markets and 24-hour truck stops.
Yeah.
So we've seen that the poorest people in North America once had some of the healthiest diets because they were foraging, they were gardening, they were gleaning fruits off the streets, and now they're suffering some of the worst nutritional problems because of these fast food diets in what are called food deserts throughout the U.S.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with Zola, the wedding company that will do anything for love. Zola is reinventing the wedding planning and registry experience to make the happiest moment in couples' lives even happier. From engagement to wedding and decorating your first home, Zola's there, combining compassionate customer service with modern tools and technology. And of course, it's all in the service of love. It's so easy to plan your wedding because there's so many features all in one place. 500,000 couples have already used Zola. You get free wedding websites, your dream wedding registry, affordable save the dates and invitations, and super easy to use planning tools. Guys, this free website is where you get started. And it's, you know, one of the best parts of Zola. It's super easy. It takes just minutes to set up. There are over 100 beautiful wedding website designs to choose from that fit any style. And you can put your Zola registry on your wedding website so that your guests can see all the details they need and buy your wedding gift in one convenient and, of course, as I said, beautiful place. And of course, speaking of your registry, you can build it. You can build the registry of your dreams right there at Zola. They make registering so, so easy. They've got the widest selection of gifts at all different price points. Your guests are going to love free shipping and returns, price matching, and more. There are over 500 top brands from OXO to Cuisinart to Sonos and Airbnb. You can help create funds for your honeymoon, register for gift cards, and also they have the best completion discount, 20% off remaining gifts on your registry starting right after your big day. So what are you waiting for? To start your free wedding website and also get $50 off your registry on Zola, go to zola.com/nerdy. That's zola.com/nerdy. I also want to thank Calm for continuing to support the show. I've told you before, I'm going to continue to tell you how much I love Calm, and that's because it really has changed my life for the better. Calm is the number one app to help you sleep, meditate, and relax. And if you head on over to calm.com/nerdy, you're going to get 25% off of a Calm Premium membership. That includes hundreds of hours of programming. There are guided meditations for things like anxiety, stress, and focus. There's even a brand new meditation each day called the Daily Calm. There's also kind of less guided meditation for those of you who are maybe a little bit more advanced and want to be alone with your thoughts and practice your own mindfulness skills. But if you're super scared to dive into meditation, I'm telling you, these guided sessions make it really, really easy to get started. There are even series that allow you to do like the 7 days of gratitude or the 7 days of happiness or just the 7 days of calm. That's a good place to start. There are also sleep stories. They're like bedtime stories for adults, which is pretty awesome. Even Bob Ross is in there because how could he not be? And there's soothing music. It's one of my favorite parts. Breathing exercises, gentle stretches, a whole lot more. I listen to the music when I listen to the focus music when I'm reading for school and writing papers, but I listen to the sleep music every night when I go to bed. Calm's become a big part of my daily routine. So I don't know what you're waiting for. For a limited time, Talk Nerdy listeners can get 25% off of a Calm Premium subscription at calm.com/nerdy. Again, that's calm.com/nerdy, where you get unlimited access to all of Calm's content today. I did it. I actually bought myself a lifetime subscription because I love it that much. You can get 25% off of your Calm Premium subscription at calm.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
Yeah, you know, the food desert conversation is a fascinating one to me, and I'm interested in your perspective. I don't know as much about it as I would like to, but I did, when I was working as a journalist on a show here in Los Angeles called SoCal Connected, which is like kind of a public television news and current events show, I spent some time in El Monte, which is a city that is a predominantly Latinx city. And there at the time, there was only like one grocery store, and there historically hadn't even been a grocery store. So unfortunately, people were buying their produce, their dairy products from like liquor stores. And we went to a community garden and talked about the CSA program and some of the really cool things that were happening at the community garden level. But I got these great insights from the local people about the fact that, you know, people used to just grow their own food here and, you know, access the fruit trees in their yards and the gardens in their backyards. And now people are buying, like I said, bad produce from liquor stores and much more often just packaged food. I mean, that was really the bulk of the calories that the people in this, you know, poor city had access to. Is it because the food is more convenient? Is it because the only way to make a living anymore is to work so many hours a day that it's hard to actually tend to your own land? Like, is it a combination of all of these things?
You're on the money again. I mean, a lot of people who are at the lowest rungs of our economy are working such long hours, or like my father worked 2 to 3 jobs a week, that they don't have time to cook in their traditional manner or garden, you know. So, and the fact that most of those little 24-hour mini marts, either at truck stops and gas stations or on street corners, now are eligible for the use of the federal nutrition program SNAP benefits cards. Mm-hmm. Means that they virtually have no heterogeneity, no variety in their diets. They're getting cheap calories buying huge boxes or bags of chips or other highly processed foods that are fiber deficient, vitamin deficient, and mineral deficient. And that's why we have such a widespread batch of nutrition-related diseases now, not just diabetes, but gluten allergies and celiac disease and other kinds of food allergies. But it's that monotony of the diet that friends of mine have shown is really a worldwide problem now, that the diets today all around the world are more like one another, from China to Italy to the United States and Mexico, than ever before, because almost all those diets have lost their localized diversity, the things that you can get in their place that you can't get anyplace else. And yet, poor people are not passive victims to this. In Tucson, where I live, Chicano-anchored collective called Flowers and Bullets is taking over a school in Midtown Tucson, in what might be called a food desert or blighted area, and turning it into a food justice center. Mm-hmm. We have refugees in Tucson that are gleaning 400,000 pounds of fruits off the medians and parks and schoolyards and backyards in Tucson, and making those into healthy value-added products to sell to their neighbors. So nearly every city in the United States has food justice projects among African Americans, immigrants, Hispanic Americans, that are really resetting the discussion about food and food justice. And we all need to support those projects because they're essential to the survival of our neighbors now.
Yeah, I mean, they're born out of necessity, as you said, and it really does take, I think, these activists with really, honestly, very public displays at the bleeding edge to raise awareness. There's, you know, famously an individual in Los Angeles named Ron Finley, who had some real issues with the legal system for several years because he was making it his mission to plant that strip, it's not really the median, but the strip between the sidewalk and the street that almost everybody has in their front yard if they own or rent a home, that they were planting fruits and vegetables in those areas. And the city, like, was fining him and citing him over and over, claiming that that's their land, even though we're responsible for tending it, and that you couldn't grow food there. And ultimately, it got so much attention that sort of favor started to fall on the side of the food justice activists, and we've seen change here in LA because of that. But it takes sometimes people putting themselves in precarious situations with their activism to make sure that these real issues that are in many ways hidden from those of us who are more secure become known.
Well, that's a great example, and I really admire Finley's work We have a local hero like that in Tucson, a water harvesting guru named Brad Lancaster. And about 7 or 8 summers ago, he and his brother were out on a Sunday morning with a jackhammer cutting the curb in front of their house to allow water to come in off the street to water that little area between the curb and the sidewalk, as you were describing. And the neighbors called the city police, and the city police called the parks and rec people who knew about these things. And they came over, and Brad explained what he was doing, that if everyone did that on a mile-long stretch of urban streets, at 400 mature fruit trees could be watered with that drainage off the street after summer showers in Tucson. Wow. And that it would not only shade and reduce the urban heat island effect, but it could produce thousands of pounds of fruit and nuts per mile of roadway in Tucson. And so rather than fining him, they asked Brad to write a grant to get Tucson neighborhoods more block grant monies to do that kind of thing. And now mile after mile, the different barrios and neighborhoods in Tucson are curb cutting with the help of the city rather than against them. And they're saving thousands of gallons per year, about 740 gallons of water that for outdoor landscaping that would otherwise have to come from the city water supply. So now Tucson is actually subsidizing that curb cutting and tree planting to the tune of $500 to $2,000 a family. So what was a conflict and a standoff for a while between food and water activists in the city is now a win-win situation that is literally re-diversifying the edible landscape of Tucson, where now we have over 200 kinds of domesticated fruit and nut trees, another 300 kinds of wild food plants that are planted in people's yards and in medians. And through our free seed libraries in Tucson, about 2,200 different kinds of garden vegetables and herbs have their seeds available to anyone in the city through our public library system. More than 24 libraries in Tucson now have free seed libraries for food plants.
That's incredible. And I have to say, like, absolutely genius. And it raises this question, this conversation that we haven't really touched on, but is obviously so linked to the conversation we've been having so far, which is about that disconnect in many places between rich and poor when it comes to actual tree cover, when it comes to how much concrete is there in your neighborhood and how much are the trees providing shade, becoming these heat sinks and providing, you know, oxygenating the air, increasing biodiversity in these areas. There's also a high correlation, isn't there, between having less and living in concrete.
That's right. And Chicana activist in Tucson, Nelda Dora Martinez and her friend Nelda have pointed this out, that if you look at Google Maps or the aerial photos of Tucson, it's the poorest neighborhoods that have the least tree cover and the most need for it. And yet we have a group called Trees for Tucson that's associated with America Clean and Beautiful, that over the last dozen or so years has distributed 180,000 edible shade trees into poor neighborhoods and even into prisons and schools in blighted areas of Tucson to increase that tree cover. And now we're planting trees along all the bike paths and walking paths. So I don't think the problem is solved, but it's really going in the right direction that we're moving back to being a city of trees in Tucson and in many other places, Albuquerque and Los Angeles, where we used to have just pavement and concrete that really worsened the summer nighttime temperatures in nearly every city in the United States.
Mm-hmm. But of course, there are still places that aren't hip to this this important issue, and, you know, local governments that aren't doing what they could potentially be doing to work with their citizens to help improve these outcomes. And that's, I think, that's a real tragedy. And hopefully people are waking up, like you said, across the country. You mentioned the seed program that the local libraries have. And it's such a smart thing, right? Because when it comes to food insecurity and when it comes to an inability to pay for food except for the most kind of nutritionally absent but calorically dense foods, like a Happy Meal from McDonald's, the equal and opposite answer there is that when you grow your own food, it's like ludicrously inexpensive, or at least it can be if you do it the right way. I mean, seeds cost almost nothing, don't they?
Well, they do, but providing free or discounted access to seeds really helps. I just did a survey of Home Depots and other kinds of hardware stores for seed packets. And sometimes for 12 squash or watermelon seeds, people are paying $2.50 for a little packet. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's absurd, because all of us, when we eat a watermelon, can simply put the seeds of that watermelon in a paper towel and keep them. But many families who are below poverty level don't realize that their SNAP benefits, their EBT cards, can help them buy seeds and transplants of tomatoes and squashes and onions, or real fruit trees rather than just buying tomatoes. You can buy tomato transplants to put on your windowsill, your patio, or your garden. Yeah. And so now 20 of the farmers markets in Tucson allow people to buy seeds and seedlings and fruit trees with their EBT cards. And you have other great programs that I think speak to the issue that you mentioned a minute ago about how cities were sort of at odds with the activists working on these things. You have this great group in the Bay Area around San Francisco called Guerrilla Grafters, which are taking cuttings of delicious fruit trees and grafting them onto ornamental plums and apples in city parks, and putting 10 to 15 kinds of fruit on the same tree to grow in public spaces.
Wow.
And at one time, when the city of San Francisco found out that the guerrilla grafters were doing that, they said, well, if they're damaging our trees and our parks, we're just going to have to arrest those people. And Tara Wee, one of the organizers of Guerrilla Grafters, got that out on social media, and within 2 days, they had more donations to help them with this, and more new members willing to help graft and care for these trees in public parks than they could have gotten if they hadn't had that bad publicity from the city. Mm. So these are kinds of the Robin Hoods of our era, the people that are making food accessible in city parks and county parks without tacit permission of the land managers, but they really want to see this food available to the homeless and to kids coming home from school and all of that kind of thing.
It's so fundamentally important to everything, to our health, to our democracy, to, you know, really who we are. And you obviously are so informed about the programs that are taking place across the country. You have the projects that you yourself are working on. You also are associated with, not just associated, you What is your relationship with the University of Arizona Southwest Center? Are you on staff or faculty there? Like, how does that work?
Right. I'm a field researcher like my other colleagues there, but I also helped found the Center for Regional Food Studies 3 years ago that helped Tucson get the designation as the first UNESCO City of Food Cultures in the United States.
Wow.
And so a lot of my work is really applied research and community outreach. On top of that, I have my own orchard and two greenhouses and a pond on my land in Patagonia, Arizona. And we bring students down here to learn how to graft and prune trees and make value-added products from fruits, healthy beverages. And so I'm the Kellogg Endowed Chair in Borderland Food and Water Security at the university, but it's really like a food system extension role where I'm out in the communities as much as I'm on campus.
That's incredible. And so, and you write a lot to share these conversations with a broader audience and, you know, do things like sit with me on the podcast. So what are you working on now? I can't imagine that you're not working on either another book or a new project. You know, where are your sights today?
Well, in addition to this Mesquite Manifesto, which is a vision for reducing the disparities in the borderlands through food justice, I'm working on an agave festival with businessmen and nurserymen and botanical gardens in Tucson that will be in its sixth year. That runs from April 25th to May 5th, which is talking about century plants like the tequila plant and mezcal plant, not only for alcoholic beverages, but for foods and other products. I spent the fall on the Lebanon-Syria border, looking at how we can help the many refugees from war-stricken areas and helping support women's co-ops and collectives that are making value-added products. And I hope to begin a refugee farmer readaptation camp or farm program here in the Southwest, where whether the refugees are from Syria or from some other country, if they were farmers, they get a chance to learn about opportunities here in the U.S. to be farmers or farm managers or farm workers that have a skill set that helps them get better wages. And they can really help us deal with the shortage of farmers and farm workers we now have in the U.S. Southwest. We're underplanting acreage of chilies and tomatoes and other hand-harvested crops simply because most people now prefer to live in cities rather than in rural areas and be part of the rural workforce, and we're flipping that around.
It's just incredible. The work that you do is so incredibly important. Gary, you know, we're starting to run a little bit low on time. And when I close my podcast each week, I ask my guests the same two questions, and they're really big picture questions. And I'm going to be fascinated, I think, by your perspective, because of the work that you do. So, are you open to taking a stab at these two questions?
I love those big, hairy questions.
Perfect. All right. So I would love to know from you, when you look to the future in whatever context is, you know, feels relevant to you right now, whether it's personal, whether it's global, or maybe somewhere in between. Number one, what is the thing that really is keeping you up at night that you are maybe a little bit pessimistic, maybe even bordering on cynical about, that you're legitimately, you know, worried about? But on the flip side of that, what is the thing that you genuinely are optimistic about in a real way?
Well, I'll give an example from Arizona, but it applies to much of the world today. And that's that the collateral damage done to human health by our industrialized, commodified, chemically intensive food system. Mm-hmm. The collateral damage costs more than the annual agricultural harvest in Arizona. So there's actually more of a cost of people eating bad food in Arizona than the benefits that our agricultural system provides to our populace in this state. I mean, that's staggering that all the subsidies go to cotton farmers and to GMO seeds and all of that. And our land grant colleges are not doing what they were set up to do, which was to provide food self-sufficiency and good jobs and healthy eating opportunities to our urban and rural dwellers of any state. And I think we have to turn that around. And I'm happy with the incredible nutrition program at our university that's really doing food justice work at its core. But we need to move our government back to helping create agricultural oases in cities and in our rural areas that can feed our population. We'll always have imported food, or we'll bring in food from other states and from the oceans. But unless we take care of the land now and bring on this next generation of young farmers and gardeners and orchard keepers and aquaculturalists, we will be bankrupting our country because of the rising costs of the health problems that come out of the damage that our industrialized food system is doing to our people.
And so, you know, on the flip side of that, is there anything that you really do feel optimistic about, maybe related to this, maybe something different that you're seeing that change really is afoot?
I am so excited by all the kids on fire about food systems. I'm excited by the participation of every ethnic group, from Somali refugees to Native Americans, in taking control of their own food system again. The seed libraries have gone viral across the country, and free seeds are available in hundreds of libraries and food banks around the country. And in Tucson alone, we have 125 new foods, healthy foods from native and heirloom products, and 50 new micro enterprises just within the last few years that are a counter movement to our industrialized food system. And sooner or later, it will begin to change that system. And so I'm really behind these efforts that we call the middle path in agriculture and the radical center in ranching, to bring environmentalists and food activists and health activists together with food producers to chart a new course for our food system.
Well, Gary, this has been a fascinating, fascinating chat. Guys, the book is Mesquite and Arboreal Love Affair, but it's not just that book. Gary, how many, I'm trying to count here, you've written over a dozen books. I mean, written or edited so many.
Well, I was in LA and San Diego last week, and one of the people introducing me had tallied all of my books and said it's now 37, which I didn't know. And what I'm saying is, I probably hit my word quota, and I should just stay silent and get back to taking care of our own orchard and greenhouses a little bit better than being at the desk all the time. But I'm so grateful to the readers who inspire me to write more, because they're the people that I care about. I write with the needs of readers in mind. And I think that unless we have dialogue in our public settings about all these issues, we're bankrupting future generations. And so I'm grateful by how many people, since when I wrote the first book about the local food movement coming home to eat, have just stepped up to the plate and done remarkable things in their communities.
Absolutely. So guys, check out all of Gary's books. You can go to his website and learn more. Gary, thank you so much for joining me. This has just been, it's been a blast.
Oh, I'm so grateful for you, Kara, and I love to talk nerdy.
Yes, I love it. And everybody else who's listening, thank you for coming back week after week. We're looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.